This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. In November of 1783, George Washington received word that a peace treaty with England had been signed. Washington was eager for peace, and he wished to be home for Christmas. During the war, he had returned just once to Mount Vernon, just once over the course of more than 8 years. George Washington and his journey home are the subjects of Stanley Weintraub's book, General Washington's Christmas Farewell. Listeners, let me share this with you. It's from the preface to the book. His homeward journey would be an escalating triumph, a celebration of a human being as godlike as grateful Americans could envision. It would also be a test of his stubborn humility. He hoped to withdraw from fame and return to his plow. But could he? Stanley Weintraub is Evan Pugh Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Pennsylvania State University. He's the author of numerous histories and biographies. Next month, his latest book, Iron Tears, America's Battle for Freedom, Britain's Quagmire, 1775 to 1783, is due in bookstores. His book, General Washington's Christmas Farewell, is now available in paperback from Plume, a division of Penguin. Professor Weintraub, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you.
What were George Washington's hopes for peacetime for himself and for the states?
I think Washington wanted a peace that would not include him. That was primary. He felt that he had had 8 years of war. He had been home only once in all of that time. He was using his opportunity to go home for Christmas at the signing of the peace treaty to somehow get out of public life, and he hoped it would be forever. But I think the trip home, which took him from the 4th of December when he left New York City to Christmas Eve when he actually returned to Mount Vernon, showed him that he might not be able to get away with civilian life, private life altogether.
Yeah, he was celebrated everywhere he went, from New York to Philadelphia to Annapolis.
He should have expected that because he had been celebrated for so long. He was the glue that held the 13 disunited United Colonies together during the Revolution since 1775. He knew that he would be lionized this way. Admiring citizens who had lived under monarchs all their lives, the common form of rule everywhere, thought that perhaps they could even replace George III with George I.
Mm-hmm.
And he was to one poet of the time, our hero, guardian, father, friend. Another poet called him the first of men. Someone wrote that had he lived in days of idolatry, he would have been worshipped like a god. And to some people, especially as he traveled home, when more people got to see him than just his soldiers, he looked godlike because, unusually for his time, he was 6'4", a very big man and very dignified in appearance, and to them he was larger than life.
Mm. When word came that the treaty with England had been signed, what tasks remained before he could set off on his way home to Virginia?
The chief bargaining chip that the British held during the negotiations had been New York City. It had never been recaptured by the Americans. They never even tried. They knew that it was not possible because it was surrounded so much by water that it would have been difficult to capture. And now they were going to be able to take it without a fight. The British were eager to get home. They had been away a long time also. And Washington was not only eager to take it, but then to get on a barge to New Jersey and head home for Christmas.
Yeah. Would you describe for us the scene at the tavern, at Francis Tavern, where Washington toasted his men?
I think that's one of the most moving events in American history. Washington saying goodbye to his officers, those who remained. Much of the army had melted away by this time, either because they hadn't been paid or, like Washington, wanted to go home for Christmas.
Yeah.
But he had some of them left. They gathered at Francis Tavern in Lower Manhattan near the Battery, and he wanted to say goodbye to them and just didn't have it in him to give a speech. He was choked up. He was in tears, so were the soldiers, all officers. They knew that they would never see him again. The country was 1,800 miles long along the coast. It was a huge place. Travel was difficult. Hopefully there would not be another war and they would never get together again. And when he tried to speak to them, all he could say was, I would like to say goodbye to you individually. Would you come up and shake my hand? And one by one, in order of rank, they, with General Knox, the head of the artillery first, they came up and they shook hands with him. They embraced, they wept, and he had prepared wine and cold meats at the inn at Bronce's Tavern for them for a lunch, and nobody could eat it. They just stood around.
Yeah.
And finally, he waved his hand to them. He couldn't speak about it. He waved his hand and goodbye and strode out the door to the barge that was going to take him to New Jersey.
Yeah. You know, something very telling in that moment that you include is a little detail that Washington lifted his glass and then he waited for all the men that were there with him to have their glasses filled.
And he knew that no one wanted to say anything. There were no words for the fact that they had lived together and fought together and struggled together for so many years, and now it was all over. It was an experience that could never be repeated.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting recently in reading about the retirement of General George Patton from his army in Austria at the end of World War II, he was being relieved and sent to another command, and one of his colonels, realizing that people there adored Patton, and yet nobody could speak about it, they raised their glasses of wine again, and he said it reminded him of Bronce's Tavern. In other words, that image has stuck with people.
Another very touching moment of this story comes some days later, noon, on December 23rd, in Annapolis.
Annapolis was where the Continental Congress, no longer called that, it was the Confederation Congress, was meeting. Washington, as an act of theater, wanted to publicly return his commission as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces to the President of the Congress so he could officially return to Mount Vernon to be a civilian. He wanted to do that very publicly because he felt that it was important for the country to return to its civil origins, not to be a militarist country and not to have him forever as its commander. He made then the only farewell address that he ever gave in his life. And it surprised me when I was researching this book to realize that the famous farewell address that he gave, or that he was supposed to be giving in 1796 at the end of his presidency, was never delivered. He didn't even write it. Alexander Hamilton wrote it. And Washington had it published in a newspaper. The only farewell address that he ever delivered in person in his own voice was the one he gave at Annapolis the day before Christmas Eve. And again, grown men could weep back then. It was quite okay. The stiff upper lip wasn't in fashion yet. And everyone wept as he said his goodbye, as he said that he was now returning, as he would put it many times, to live under his own vine and his own fig tree, quoting the Book of Kings and the Bible. And he handed back his papers, and the President of the Congress, Thomas Mifflin, commented about that the glory of your virtues won't terminate with your military command. It will continue to animate the remotest ages. And Washington shook hands with the officers of the Congress and slipped out the door, got on his horse, and with a small party of aides, went down toward the Potomac River, and the next morning crossed over to Virginia. And so he didn't get home until December 24th. Twilight came early in the winter, and as he climbed up the slopes to Mount Vernon, he could see the candles in the window beckoning. He managed to get home by Christmas Eve, and he was very lucky he did, because the next day a heavy snowfall locked him into snow and ice. And he was very grateful for it because he had some privacy. He could take off his uniform and be the farmer that he said he wanted to be again. And all the retired general planned to confront was what he would call an attack of Christmas pies. That was his Christmas celebration.
You begin this book by telling readers about the excitement you were greeted with when you told some very young history students that you were planning a book set during the War for Independence, and you were surprised by how much they knew of the country's early history. And what was delightful was the questions that they put to you.
I found it fascinating. These were first graders and fourth graders, my grandchildren's classes in Washington State. I told them that I was working on a book about Washington going home at the end of the war, and that the period of no war, no peace that had ended with the Battle of Yorktown, that had begun with the Battle of Yorktown, was ending. And they knew all about Yorktown, and they knew a lot that I hadn't expected about the war, but they had questions. I said Washington wanted to go home for Christmas. They wanted to know how he did it, what transportation was like. I said he had to ride on a horse. What was the horse's name? And it made me do my homework, and I found out that the horse's name was Nelson, because it was given to Washington by the governor of South Carolina, whose name was Benjamin Nelson. And Washington, at the end of the war, since the horse survived, returned Nelson to Nelson. And lots of little things like that occurred. They wanted to know what Christmas was like then. Were there Christmas trees? What about Santa? And I did my homework for it. It appears in the book. What was the colonial Christmas like?
Yeah.
What was travel like, crossing down the states along the Atlantic seaboard into Maryland and finally across the river into Virginia? He went right by my house, by the way. I live in Delaware, quite close to the route that he took toward Elkton, Maryland, and into Baltimore, and finally into Washington.
Yeah. Well, reading the book, I cheered for the students of Thomas Jefferson School in Pullman, Washington, because I took great delight in knowing that Nelson was a gray stallion and Washington's horse, and that on the way home to Mount Vernon, George Washington hoped to purchase gifts for his wife, Martha. What kinds of things would he have been looking for to bring to Martha?
He looked for presents for Martha that were useful, stockings and a scarf, for example. And for the children, he had step-grandchildren. He had no children of his own. And for them, he looked for whatever toys were then available. And it turned out that at Mount Vernon, I found facsimiles of the toys that were available that Christmas. Little stuffed dolls and wooden wagons and wooden boats. The sort of thing that could have been made by a craftsman back then. And you can now buy the kinds of presents that Washington brought home to his step-grandchildren at the gift shop in Mount Vernon.
Interesting. Well, I read the book with a paperweight in my hand, and it depicts Mount Vernon there on the paperweight, and it was lovely to think of it all. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and we've used up the time, unfortunately. Perhaps we can talk when Iron Tears hits the
I hope we can.
Bookshelves.
We'll have to work that out next month.
Okay, very good. Professor Stanley Weintraub has been our guest this afternoon. His book, General Washington's Christmas Farewell, is now available in paperback from Plume. It's a division of Penguin. Next month, his book, Iron Tears, America's Battle for Freedom, Britain's Quagmire, 1775 to 1783, due in bookstores.